It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 71 for Friday the 13th of April 2012. On the show today, Facebook buys a popular photography app that makes everyone's photography look the same, but put $1 billion into doing so. A French designer has chosen human hair as the central component in a new range of household items, including cups and jugs. And could you use just computer code to accurately describe a chicken? If you want a job at Google, you'll need to, and we'll find out more of the unusual questions you may need to know the answer to later on. But first, it's all the latest and greatest from this week in Wired News. Ahoy there, Nate Langson here, editor of course, Wired.co.uk. Joining me, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
I love it when I say of course, don't you?
Well, yeah, because I never really understand why you say it.
No, me neither. Also, associate editor Olivia _ to the Solon.
Hello.
Now, we've got an exciting bit of news today, haven't we? Because, you know, my favourite game ever of the last year.
Yo, which favourite game ever is this,
Nate? Skyrim just got Kinect support. So I can shout dragon shouts literally at my TV to control my powers in the game. Very exciting.
Can I make a request?
Go on.
Can you do a dragon shout now? You may need to step back from the microphone a little.
No.
Why not?
Because it would be incredibly annoying to anyone listening. It would be very loud. They'd fall over. No, it'd be an absolute mess.
I don't know what a dragon shout is.
It's like Fusro...
Liv doesn't know. You're going to have to do it.
Fusro Dar. You know, if I did
that doesn't really sound like the Dragonborn.
It will... No. It doesn't matter what it means. It means that someone gets knocked back with the force of a dragon.
It's like dragon language. Fus, ro, and da mean three different things. One is like force, balance,
push,
something like that.
Yeah. So is that a dragon talking?
Yeah, well, kind of. It's a dragon talking through you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Facebook, Liv, it's bought Instagram, that photography app everyone's so, for some reason, obsessed with.
Yes.
Why?
Why have they bought it?
Yes, why have they bought it? For $1 billion, no less.
Yeah, well, it's the biggest investment they've made to date by a long, long way. And people are a little bit confused as to why they've bought it. Obviously, Facebook is the biggest photo sharing site, so it is all about photos, and perhaps it needs to protect its turf a little bit. And Instagram's something that's making a lot of headway in this space with 30 million users. However, some have argued that it's because Facebook's mobile apps are just not up to scratch. And Instagram has a fantastic mobile interface on iOS and now Android. So they're thinking that it's going to get a lot of capability in mobile apps in this acquisition.
So it's about buying in the staff and the expertise.
Exactly.
And but there's a lot of people that have been, a lot of backlash, because Instagram so much is about having followers and following people.
Yeah.
And so you see what the photos that they take out on the go that have all got a bit of a retro feel to it. And I think a lot of people are worried that that's going to go away.
Well, they've specifically said they're not going to be just rolling it into Facebook. They're going to keep Instagram as a separate business, or at least that's what Zuckerberg has said so far, perhaps waiting until people feel a bit more comfortable with the idea. But yes, and the other reason people have suggested is, you know, it's got to defend itself against other social networks. You've got things like Pinterest that are rising that are very image-based, and Instagram is a bit more credible in the image space with more arty, creative people, I think. Mm.
It's interesting that it's Facebook that bought this and not Tumblr.
But I'm not sure whether Tumblr would be able to afford the $1 billion price tag that Zuckerberg splashed out on it.
True. What do we think? Do we think Instagram is actually worth $1 billion?
Yeah, I find it weird. I don't know if it's worth it at the present, but it's worth more to Facebook because it's a potential competitor.
Yeah, if they've put $1 billion behind something, then they've got plans for that. That's not a small acquisition. That's a whole lot of money. So whatever they're doing, you know, it's going to be probably quite big.
But it is important to note, Instagram hasn't really got any revenue-generating model, obviously, apart from being bought by Facebook. So it'll be interesting to see what Facebook does to monetize it, especially under increasing shareholder scrutiny.
Mm. It will be interesting, though it should be said, of course, that when Google picked up YouTube many moons ago, there was no revenue generation on YouTube either. It was costing them a huge amount of money to keep it going.
It was, yeah. Well, we'll keep our eye very closely.
You just sounded so bored when you said
I just want to move on.
No, I know you do.
Tetris and children
and lazy eyes
and eye problems. There is a connection here, a theme, if you will.
A theme is emerging. Lazy eyes, some of the listeners will know, some may not, is an optic disorder where your visual stimulation transmits badly through the optic nerve, and as a result you get kind of blurry vision. It happens during childhood and it affects kind of 1-5% of the population. Now normally the way doctors deal with this is getting children to wear eye patches, which obviously they're not terribly keen on.
But the new a new method for helping this is to play a game that was developed in the 1980s.
Yes, kind of. It's children wearing a pair of special sort of goggles and playing a specially designed tweaked version of Tetris, where one image shows a very bright picture of the falling polygonal blocks, but the
tetrominoes, I think they're called
tetrominoes. Yeah, those go to the lazy eye, and a very dim image of the kind of wall of bricks where they're going down to is shown to the other eye, and it forces the two eyes to work together.
I see. And how long does this go on for?
The results so far have shown that after playing it for about an hour a day over kind of about a week, kids get an almost immediate improvement, and their schoolwork begins to improve almost immediately. And so it's significantly better than current treatments.
Also, they won't be being bullied because they're wearing an eye patch at school.
Well, yes, exactly.
Plus, they're the cool kids who get to play games as part of medication,
yeah,
which I've never managed, sadly. So this is a clinical trial, right?
Yeah, that's what's happening at the moment. It's being developed at Glasgow Caledonian University by Anita Simmers and Pamela Knox, who began piloting it in 2010.
Well, let's keep our eye on it as it develops. Liv, military robocopters, they've been in the news again, specifically our news.
They have indeed. It's the US Navy has been testing a new 3D sensor system that can be attached to a robotic helicopter to help spot pirate ships in busy shipping lanes.
And how does it work?
Well, it's got a number of different sensors to get really high definition images, including infrared and LADAR, which is laser radar, and high definition cameras. And it uses all of these, attaches it to a helicopter that can then fly above busy, busy shipping lanes, which have legitimate ships and then pirate ships. And it can compare the images that it's seeing with a database of suspected pirate ships, and then alert the kind of human operators of the robotic helicopter of any suspicious ships, which they can then check out and ascertain whether or not they are in fact pirate ships.
So the idea here is presumably for these to operate in a swarm of some sort rather than just one helicopter buzzing around the world.
Well, yeah, there could be many of these, but I think one could survey over a very large shipping area and just cut down on the number of people that are needed to scour through this footage, because it's kind of automatically looking for stuff that's suspicious.
And I guess, I mean, that the end game here is to reduce the amount of kind of cargo that's being threatened every year. I mean, it's billions of dollars, isn't it, every year?
Yeah. In the first quarter of 2012, there were 87 attacks on vessels worldwide, with 92 people taken hostage. And that's according to the ICC, International Maritime Bureau. So it's a pretty big business for pirates at the moment.
Yeah.
And so it's worth spending quite a bit of money on technology to prevent this.
Mm. I kind of want to have a play. It makes me think a little bit like, you know, those quadcopters that have got like the four rotor blades.
Yep.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me, in my head, I'm seeing a swarm of those sort
of right.
flying
around.
Oh,
right. These look like full-size helicopters, yeah, as opposed to your little remote control toys.
But they're drones, right?
They're drones, but they are pretty full-sized compared with, you know, they're not quadricopters.
Yeah, they're not small.
Mini
you can't
ones.
Bat them out of the sky.
No, you can't.
I wonder if this will kind of like develop into an arms war where pirates will start shooting down helicopters that
yeah.
they see above them. It's they'll entirely possible.
Yeah, they'll develop the helicopter recognition technology to look out for drones.
Okay, Duncan, brains. Brains have been in the news recently as well.
Brains are always in the news.
Give me some brain news.
Brain news. You want some brain
news?
Well,
I want some hot brain news, please.
A chap called Aaron Barbie from the University of Illinois has been leading a team of neurologists trying to map exactly which regions of the brain are associated with which different types of intelligence and cognitive processes.
Okay, how exactly have they been doing this?
Okay, this is kind of interesting, actually. They got veterans of the Vietnam War who had very, very localized brain damage from sort of penetrating head injuries, where they've been damaged very, very much in a very small area of the brain. And 182 of them volunteered to take part in this study. Mm-hmm. They asked them to take cognitive tests to kind of work out different sort of how they were, what aspects, I guess, of their intelligence had been harmed in as part of their injuries. And they took CT scans as well. And they correlated those into a three-dimensional map of the brain that shows what kind of damage in a particular region will have what effects.
And what parts of the brain physically are we looking at here? Are we talking like just right at the front or right at the back?
So the particular regions of the brain that are responsible for general intelligence are the ones that are mostly on the left-hand side, behind, directly behind the forehead, just behind the left ear, and at the top rear left of the head. And it just so happens that those are the regions that are also responsible for planning and self-control and other types of executive function in the brain.
I'm with you. But this isn't to do with treatment, is it? It's more about sort of actually mapping the brain more accurately.
Accurately, yeah, exactly. It's about sort of working out if you get brain damage in a specific area, what the impacts on a person's sort of cognitive functions are likely to be in that area. It's working out what bit of the brain does what.
Mm. You know, it's kind of funny. There's been a lot of stuff in the news recently about brains. I mean, we've had way more than one brain story a week over the last month or so. There's that thing at the Wellcome Trust where they've got all these amazing glass sculptures of brains where they've
basically... And real brains.
And real brains, yeah. But they've got these incredible sculptures of sort of brains with all the intricate little neurons on the inside.
Well, you know what they say.
Go on.
No brain, no gain.
Oh, I see what you did there. Good braining there. Well, we're going to take a quick break while we brain a bit more. But when we come back, where is Apple getting its next $100 billion from? It's time to guess.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Liv, let me ask you a question. If you were worth $600 billion, where would you want to get $100 billion more from?
I wouldn't. That would be enough for me, I think. Yeah? I would go and live on an island, surround myself with gold and miniature ponies, and live the high life for the rest of my days.
Duncan?
I would probably invest in a bazillion subscriptions to Wired and get really good ideas from those.
Okay, well, they were both terrible answers. But Liv, you've had we had an excellent post, a guest post, in fact, on Wired this week about where Apple's next $100 billion is going to come from.
Yes, we did. This was a guest opinion from a guy called Ramzi Yacob, who's a digital strategist at an agency called Think. And he was arguing that obviously Apple could go in many different directions, but he was noticing that there's a lot of companies that have been launching apps and pieces of hardware that make it easier to make payments on the go. We've seen things like Square, we've seen iZettle, Empower and PayPal here. And it's all about being able to, you know, turn a single sole trader into suddenly a credit card processing tradesman. But what Ramsey believes is that Apple could very soon start to insist on taking its cut from the 2.5 to 2.75 transaction fee that these companies tend to charge people to use their service, because nearly all of them seem to promote their services using imagery of iPhones and iPads. It seems almost like when you look on any of these websites, and I did it just before the podcast, you look at them and it's almost like it's an Apple advertisement, each of them. There's not an Android handset in sight, I'm afraid.
No. So this is basically Apple getting to take a tiny cut of every purchase made off the, you know, iPhone equivalent of a Visa card or
exactly.
A MasterCard.
Yeah.
That seems like quite an obvious place to get $100 billion
yeah.
from.
Yeah,
quite
exactly.
frankly.
And it's, you know, very small slice of the action, but if there's that many transactions, if the mobile payment market does explode in a way that it's expected to, it could be a massive new revenue stream for Apple.
I'm not entirely sure I agree with his premise that just because marketing companies put Apple products in their advertising, that kind of means that Apple is going to suddenly dominate mobile payments.
I don't think it's just because of that, but I think, unfortunately, it still is it's been seen as the go-to brand and the brand that is getting consumer confidence with regards to these payment systems.
But Apple hasn't made any kind of investments in terms of hardware, in terms of allowing this. And they've had several opportunities now in terms of products, whereas Android phones have actually started putting NFC chips
well,
and stuff in
It's not
in
just
their,
about NFC,
hardware.
It's about those little hardware add-ons you have to process credit cards. This isn't just about NFC.
Think Duncan's saying that Apple hasn't itself come up with those devices. Like, that's been people like Square or Barclaycard, I think, have got one as well, or something. One of those guys have got something similar.
But they're peripherals that require a phone to be plugged, that they need to be plugged into.
So I agree with both, because, I mean, I think Apple's investment has actually been, it has been a big investment, but it's been on the back end side, you know, building out an infrastructure that can basically support this, you know, basically on a software level. So companies can just tap in to one of these systems. And Apple's got the payment system, the security, the, you know, authentication systems that these sort of devices need in order to be used legally for, you know, payment systems. But I think Duncan's point about the Android, well, about NFC is an interesting one, because it's basically becoming a battle that we're seeing starting to happen, where it's like Android is the NFC payment side of things, and Apple is the plug something into our device side of things. And they're almost, it almost looks like they're going head to head. You know, on an iPhone, you'll be able to swipe the credit card against the phone, whereas with Android, you swipe the phone against the till or something like that. We've covered NFC a lot in the past. I mean, it feels like a real battle is sort of heating up here.
Although, aren't there still rumours about Apple introducing an NFC chip in its iPhone 5?
They've been rumoured for some time. And yeah, I mean, we're probably going to see an iPhone 5 around July, June, July time. And if it has NFC in it, then it could actually put a stop to a lot of this. I mean, why would Square, for example, want to invest in a technology that rivals what Apple offers? I mean, Apple doesn't let you sell an app in the App Store if it replicates strongly functionality that the iPhone offers itself. You know, you can't necessarily make a music player unless there's something unique about it, like it's Spotify and it's streaming, or it's Last.fm because it's radio, or, you know, there's podcaster apps that have been kicked out of the store for offering podcasts, even though Apple's internal system at the time didn't let you sort of subscribe to podcasts, and they later sort of relented and relaxed their rules. But anyway, I mean, which would you rather do, Duncan? I mean, what do you think? What's the future here?
I mean, well, I'll answer your first question first, which is, which would I rather do? And the answer is, I really don't mind. Anything's got to be better than carrying around a big fat wallet all the time. I really don't. Well, it's not that fat. All right. I'm a journalist. I don't get paid that much. But it's a pain to do. And I would love any system, whatever it is, on whichever device that lets you do that better. But for me, the key thing has to be that it's device agnostic.
Yes, it does.
It can't be just Android devices that let you do this, or just Apple devices that let you do this. It has to be a thing that's accessible on any platform.
So if you've got an opinion about where Apple's going to get its next $100 billion from, or what you think of mobile payments, just visit the website wired.co.uk and search for Apple's next $100 billion. And you can comment on the story.
Okay, awesome. We've got one last quick story to get to just before we move on. And this is about, in fact, let me ask you a question, Duncan and Liv. If you were going to make drinking cups out of something, what would you make it out of?
Wood.
What would you?
Ceramics.
Wood. Ceramics. They're really boring answers. What about something like, you know, the inside
like
out?
Jazz.
No, like, I don't know.
What are you talking?
Tree bark. Actually, that is kind
of... That is wood.
All right. Well, anyway, a French designer has made some various objects, jugs and mugs and things, out of human hair. A guy called Thomas Vailly has mixed human hair with glycerin and sodium sulfite, which melted together to create a type of plastic suitable for being molded into household objects.
So that's keratin, right?
Yeah. In the hair. And he's made, cups and lamps, a jug and a frame for a mirror already. And he says that just as the body will decompose, so materials made from the body will also do so. And the work acts as a modern mirror of our own mortality and imperfection, apparently.
So does the hair dissolve, or is it just like set in a resin that sort of keeps the shape?
It's melting, really. I mean, it's all melting together to form a gloop. And then the gloop, like a kind of brownish gloop, can be used to form into something that then sets.
I'm not sure how appealing that is.
See, I think I vaguely sort of remember a few years back there was another chap who was using keratin to kind of enhance bioplastics to make them more biodegradable and give them interesting properties. I guess this is a sort of a similar process.
It is. It's the idea that it can decompose eventually.
So one day you could be collecting that little hairball out of the bottom of the plug in the shower and turning it into some useful decorative urn.
You could. Or maybe the next time you have a haircut, scoop off the hair from the floor and turn it into a nice bowl and have some cereal out of it. Now, it's all a bit bizarre. He's going to be showing it off at the Milan Design Week in, I think, in a couple of weeks.
But this isn't really actually about science, is it? It's about him just being silly.
It's not about science. It's not a commercial product. It's just a bit bizarre. Nice idea. Hair cup. Yeah, no.
Furry cup.
Yeah, thanks.
Getting to dangerous territory.
Yes, let's. I need a new sound effect as we transition into our pre-feature, mini-feature. In the latest issue of Wired, we've got an article called What to Work at Google. answer these questions, or words to that effect, actually, not having it in front of me. And we've got a series of questions and answers that have been asked during employee interviews for jobs at Google. And some of them are absolutely bizarre, and we wanted to have a bit of fun playing through some of them. Now, where should we start, Duncan? Where should we start?
Should we start with the chicken?
Yes, let's start with chickens. So, using a programming language, describe a chicken.
Describe a chicken.
Yes, using computer code. The answer is that generally interviewers want you to describe a chicken so it can be distinguished from other members of the same species. So you've got to pretend that you're starting like a social network site for poultry. The chicken's name is Blinky. It's a female chicken. It's friendly and it's dead. They want something a bit like that, but in, you know, computer code.
Okay, so sort of defining something in XML and saying this is a variable.
Yes.
And set this variable, you know. Sex equals female, and so on and so forth.
Yes, head equals small, beak equals present, body equals much larger than head by factor of X.
So the skill here essentially is knowing the...
can lay eggs equals Y.
Is knowing the...
is alive, no.
Is knowing the syntax of kind of a programming language and yeah. being able to put something into that.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. You laid the egg right on the nest there, Duncan. The second question that I plucked out here is design an evacuation plan for San Francisco. How the hell do you do that?
Well, I guess you just have to think about San Francisco and roughly
what the disaster is as well.
Yeah, work out how many people are there and work out the kind of entry and exit points of the city and work out how best you could kind of fit as many people as possible into as many vehicles as possible and as many big vehicles as possible to get out in the shortest amount of time.
Duncan, you seem to know the remarkable number of answers to
maybe
these.
I should work at Google.
Please don't. The next one's quite cool. Liv, a man, it's a bit of a riddle. I'll say it again for dramatic effect. A man, regular man, 6 foot, pushed his car to a hotel and lost his fortune. What happened, Liv?
I'd be really annoyed if I got asked this question in an interview, but the answer is he was playing Monopoly. Oh. It's like a kind of bad joke, a cracker joke, isn't it?
It is a bit. The kind of thing that your uncle asks you when you're 8.
Yeah.
And then is really smug
two
when you don't know the answer.
Leave different stations.
It is, yeah. Okay. What about... Oh, this is a cool one. I know you like this one, Duncan. If you had a stack of pennies as tall as the Empire State Building, could you fit them all in one room?
Yeah, I like this one.
Because could you personally, Duncan?
I think I could, you know. I mean, it's not asking you how many pennies there are. It's just saying, will it fit in a room? And that's quite interesting because pennies are actually very, very small on a kind of area basis. They're not very big things. And so you've got to think roughly how tall is the Empire State Building? So say it's maybe 100 stories tall, which makes it 100 times bigger than an ordinary room. So all you've got to do is break up this column of pennies into 100 individual columns. And so all you've got to do is be able to put 100 pennies down on the floor somewhere in the room, and then you can do it.
Yeah.
It's really easy.
So do they want a yes, no answer?
Well, the answer is yes.
Yes. Yeah, I can imagine that if you got asked that question, though, at an interview and you just said yes and offered nothing.
You have to show you're working, I think is the point.
Show your work. Have you been interviewing for Google as well? I'm getting quite worried now.
I've done GCSE maths. I think that's a core part of any exam.
Okay, well, we've got a couple more. We're not going to give answers, though, but we've got answers to all these and about another 17 more on the website. Imagine a country where all the parents want to have a boy. Every family keeps having children until they have a boy, then they stop. What is the proportion of boys to girls in this country?
So that one's about probabilities.
Yes, and babies. And the other one that we liked and wanted to ask was, you specifically, Duncan, are shrunk to the height of a 2p piece.
That's a lot of shrinking.
And thrown into a blender. Your mass is reduced so that your density is the same as usual. The blades start moving in 60 seconds. What the hell do you do?
Cry?
It could be you, Liv. You could be shrunk too.
Yeah, I'd be pretty
upset
by the whole
preferential
experience.
Treatment here.
I might try and climb up the centre bit, like putting my legs on the blades and then hopping out the top.
Okay.
Or just crouch down really low under the blade.
Yeah.
That would also probably work.
Mm. Interesting. Well, we've got another whole load of these on the website.
There is actually a proper mathematical answer to that one.
Oh, there are proper massive mathematical answers to all of these. If you go to wired.co.uk/googanswers, G-O-O-G answers, or one word, you'll be taken to a massive page that's got all these questions and answers. And let us know your favourites, podcast@wired.co.uk. And on that note, it's time to transition into our proper feature, which this week starts with the running of a tap.
Thank you.
This is the sound of a tap running. It's a fairly familiar sound, but this particular tap was broadcast in 1971 on Scottish TV with absolutely no explanation in the middle of regular TV programming. Katie Scott is with me to talk to me about this tap. Why are we listening to the sound of a tap running 30-odd years ago?
Well, basically, this is one of a series of installations that was made by a guy called David Hall. The series is called TV Interruptions. And as you said, they appeared on TV, Scottish TV, with no explanation whatsoever. And it was basically a sort of a TV art installation.
Bit of an experiment, right?
Very much so.
So, and this is, I know, part of a bigger exhibition that's going on at the moment at the ICA in London. Now, what is this gallery and why is this tap running so key to it?
Right, so it's an exhibition called Remote Control, and basically it's all about the impact of television on contemporary culture. So you've got everything in there from broadcast during the Romanian Revolution, where people had actually had to break into the broadcast centre to be able to get their views across to the nation, to things like the TV interruption installation.
This is not an empty academic exercise. This is
I spoke to the curator, Matt Williams, about why they wanted to put this exhibition together.
But I just wanted to emphasise both the politics, the beauty and the power and the physicality of television and, you know, the imagery that you can generate and obviously, you know, and the lower gallery installation and just how, you know, what actually goes into the kind of the processes.
When you approach the lower gallery, you'll be confronted by a massive piece of analogue transmission hardware, formerly used to broadcast Channel 4 to North East London, which artist Simon Denny has borrowed. As he explained to me, he wanted to give visitors an idea of the machinery behind television broadcasting, but also wanted to point to the servers used by the likes of Google. Again, massive pieces of hardware that your average web surfer might not know anything about.
Yeah, for people to be able to see the kind of even a small section, which is huge, of what was running this kind of hardware of distribution is also kind of nothing compared to Google's storage facilities and these kind of giant kind of data banks that they have. So it's kind of what can seem very ephemeral is actually taking a lot of resource and a lot of waste, and that's kind of, I think, minimized in the way that we experience this medium, you know. Most people think of the internet in terms of their small handsets, you know, and this is actually kind of, the hardware is extremely vast. Yeah, that was about kind of making that very, very physically present in the space.
Ira Schneider was a member of the Rain Dance Corporation, which was formed in 1969, and interested in alternative possibilities for TV, instead of just entertaining and selling people stuff.
So we were very much concerned with the ecology and the problems of oil consumption and scarcity economics. We were essentially very much interested in what Buckminster Fuller had to say about the possibilities of a future of using technology to overcome some of these things. And we knew that broadcast television was not dealing with these things because it was bought by the status quo. And it was just the medium for advertising, and entertainment was just to attract people to the advertising.
The group founded a space called the Center for Decentralized Television in New York, and Ira's drawing of a map of this graces a space next to the transmission hardware. He told me that creating videos in the 1970s was actually a physically demanding process.
Together, I was invited out to Antioch College to do a video project in their media studio. So we went out there and we also did videos using this first generation half-inch portable equipment, which was 16 pounds on the side of you, and the camera was about 8 pounds. And it took 16 hours to charge the battery, and the battery lasted for 45 minutes. So that would be two tapes, and then you'd have to recharge for 16 hours. Luckily, we had extra batteries.
So apart from these huge pieces of machinery, what else is there?
Well, when you come in, you see the lower gallery, and there's actually a bank of analog televisions. So you can stare down at the visitors who are sort of all sitting there with headphones on, kind of immersed in their viewing with, you know, the light from the TV reflected back on their face. And the TVs are showing installations about everything from the story of Apollo 11 spaceflight to love scenes taken from various BBC programmes, which were quite frankly quite funny.
Sounds a bit bizarre.
Yeah, it's got a bit of a 1984 feel to it, but Matt told me that that's exactly what they were going for.
It's kind of interesting to represent it and look at that in the way that we now, you know, for example, engage with our phones and new technology and how we constantly, you know, what did you used to do at a bus stop before you had a phone?
So what else is at the show?
Well, there's a whole series of talks running alongside the exhibition. So they tackle everything from the process of commissioning art for television to test card transmissions. And it's actually a guy from St. Etienne who's talking about that, to whether or not we engage with television now as much as we used to in the past. And Matt argues that perhaps not. He says that television used to bring people together, but now, because there's so many different new services, so many different channels, and obviously all of the content on the web, that actually sitting together as a family and viewing TV is quite a rarity.
But now it's far more fragmented. I mean, I used to be religious about watching the 6 o'clock news because I think it was like my parents, or 10 o'clock news because my parents were religious about that. Because newspaper media obviously offers you certain perspectives, left, right, centre. Broadcast news has been kind of made more and more superficial, you know, and it's this kind of, it's rancier, with politics of aesthetics, etc., you know. So you just become more and more aestheticised, and then, I don't know, maybe I'm more and more distrustful of the content or way the things are presented. So you actually choose, and as a viewer now, because of, as we were saying, about this ability to engage with anything from anywhere at any time, you choose your engagement, you choose your far more, I mean, the audience, what the audience has now is a greater choice.
The exhibition's on until the 10th of June, and it's on at the ICA in central London.
Thanks, Katie. And now it's time to pick up our podcast Prit Stick and glue on an outro. Liv, how can people get in touch?
There are many ways in which you can get in touch with us. You can call us on 0208 123 0468 and you can leave us a message of up to 30 seconds and we'll play it in the podcast.
Maybe.
Or you can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK and we've also got a fantastic Facebook page, facebook.com/WiredUK.
Yep. And of course, podcast@wired.co.uk if you want to send us an email. And on that note, in fact, shall we end on a close part harmony goodbye?
Bye.
Are you Andrew WK? Podcast@wired.co.uk. Let us know.